worldwide. This is FSF.
Thank you, Simon. Welcome to Tuesday's Richie Allen Radio Show. How you doing? Are you well?
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Right, so in the second hour of the programme, Fathers for Justice founder Matt O'Connor joins the programme. It's been a long time since I've spoken with Matt. The Fathers for Justice group pulled off another very impressive stunt yesterday afternoon outside the court case, the libel case, Johnny Depp taking the son to court over libel allegations. Fathers for Justice made a point yesterday, they say, is about an impending change to the divorce laws, which won't be good for men. Matt O'Connor in the second hour of the programme. Before that, though, I'm really looking forward to speaking to a lady who phoned in the last phone-in show, Louise May Creffield. Say that right, Richie. Louise May Creffield. She is behind, or she's one of the people behind, a new group called Save Our Rights UK. And I want to talk about that. It's apparently a new group for people who are concerned about the infringements upon our human rights, liberties and freedoms. And it's doing very well on Facebook with thousands and thousands of followers and people participating there. So Louise Creffield on the programme this hour. That's not too shabby, that is it? It's not bad for a Tuesday. And the time is coming up for 5 minutes past five. It is the 21st of July. Hi to Aaron Phelan, who's got to do a COVID test for work and is documenting the process. She'll keep us informed about that via Twitter. Thank you, Aaron. Lovely to hear from you this afternoon. The Russians are coming. The Russians are coming. If you're old enough, I'm not, but I do remember seeing the film on TCM Movies. There's a plug. TCM Movies. Funniest thing I heard today, dear listener, in a blizzard of horse manure, dear listener, and I wade through a blizzard of horse manure every day. Think of every film you ever saw in your life set in a very snowy place. Think of the opening scenes of Empire Strikes Back with Luke trying to make his way through the blizzard. That's the blizzard of horse manure I wade through every day. For you? No, I do it for me. I do it for me. It's a penance. And politicians from every party, because the lines are no longer blurred even between the parties. They're all the same. We've known that for a long time. But they've been stepping up to the microphone for the Beeb and for Sky to denounce the Russians, to denounce them, and wait for it, to denounce the danger the Russians represent to our democracy.
What kind of fuckery are you?
Democracy. There is no democracy in this country. This is a fascist dictatorship. It is. Okay, at the very least, it's a constitutional monarchy, which in itself is fascism, but I'm not going to get into that right now. There is no democracy here. What effing democracy, eh? All right then. Here's the story from the BBC. Now, you'll know that the Intelligence and Security Committee finally published their long-awaited report into Russian interference. This should have been published before the last general election back in December, but it wasn't. It was delayed. It was finally published, the long-awaited report, and this is basically what it said. It said that the UK government has actively avoided looking for Russian interference during the European Union referendum campaign. The Intelligence and Security Committee said the government was playing catch-up despite evidence of interference in the Scottish independence referendum. The committee called for immediate action by government and intelligence agencies to tackle the threat from the Ruskies. The Russian Foreign Ministry called the report Russophobia. Right, right. Here's MP Stuart Hosey, who's on the Intelligence Select Committee. Here he is speaking at the unveiling of the report today. Stuart Hosey.
The report reveals that no one in government knew if Russia interfered in or sought to influence the referendum, because they did not want to know. The UK government have actively avoided looking for evidence that Russia interfered. We were told that they hadn't seen any evidence, but that is meaningless if they hadn't looked for it. The committee found it astonishing that no one in government had sought beforehand to protect the referendum from such attempts or investigated afterwards what attempts to influence it there may have been. The government, the UK government, should have recognised the threat back in 2014 in relation to the Scottish referendum, but it didn't. It didn't understand the threat until after the hack and leak operation against the Democratic National Committee in the United States. And because it was too slow to recognise the threat, it didn't take action to protect the UK in 2016. One would have thought that once the existence of that threat had been understood, seeing what had happened in the US, that someone here would have wanted to understand the extent and nature of the threat to the UK, and we wanted to see the post-referendum assessment. But there isn't one. There has been no assessment of Russian interference in the EU referendum, and this goes back to nobody wanting to touch this issue with a 10-foot pole.
With a 10-foot pole. Nobody wants to touch it with a 10-foot pole. Yes. All across the political spectrum, as I have said, somber-looking, grim-faced politicians saying, yes, we've got to do something about the Russians. Apart from one guy on Sky News. Now, just one. I have monitored the Beeb and Sky this afternoon, thinking they will present one or two voices, one or two dissenting voices. Well, not really. One guy on Sky News called Professor Richard Sakwa. He is a professor of Russian and European politics in Kent, who's written a book on Putin. One bloke in an avalanche of anti-Russian hysteria. Professor Sakwa got onto Sky News. Now, dear listener, I bet you a thousand pounds that there was some interference on the line. I have insider information. You want to take the bet? Sakwa is coming on to say I don't agree with the findings. He is a professor of Russian politics and European politics. I bet you there is some interference on the line. He starts off by pointing out that the five expert witnesses who are the basis for the claims of Russian interference are notorious anti-Russian hawks. Professor Richard Sakwa.
If you look at the five external reports, expert witnesses who participated in the committee work.
Here comes the interference then.
All five of them are well-known hawks, if I may put it like this, on Russia meddling. And it seems astonishing that this committee didn't take alternative viewpoints. We know that there are some. Perhaps that's one reason why the report wasn't issued earlier. But all five are arguing that Russia is an existential threat. I'd like to have seen in this report a more balanced approach to the question of risk and of threats. Of course, there were issues which have to be investigated. As for the statements, you know, I expected some information about the detail about alleged interference in the Scottish referendum in the Brexit vote, instead of which we're into this endless echo chamber.
Endless echo chamber. There is enormous interference on his line, yet his picture was crystal clear and there was no distortion on the picture. Endless echo chamber, he says.
Chamber. When you have an assertion, then it's picked up by the media, then it's into the intelligence community, and then back into the media, and it becomes louder and louder. And experts who really know what's going on in Russia really don't get a look in.
This is terrible interference on the line there, and I would be suspicious of it. He says an assertion is made, it's picked up by the media who run with it. It goes back to the intelligence communities, it comes back to the media, and it gets louder and louder and louder. There isn't any real journalism, and those who are in the know about what Russia is doing, dissenting voices, are not given a platform. I have no proof that his line is being interfered with, none. I've got to say that because I'm a real journalist. I won't make stuff up, but I really suspect it is being interfered with.
Okay.
Professor, summarise us, if you would, that alternative viewpoint,
yeah,
which you say wasn't reflected by what this committee assessed.
Good man, Colin. Colin has given him a chance anyway to give the alternative viewpoint, but will the boys at GCHQ afford him the courtesy? Well, let's see.
Yeah, well, I mean, we can go back to the United States. This report seems to be very much under the influence of 2016 and Russian alleged meddling in the US, and which led on the Mueller report and so on. But after 2 years of hard work...
He's now talking about the Mueller report, and he's talking about DNC emails. He doesn't get a chance to talk about the murder of Seth Rich or any of that, because the interference gets, well, pretty horrible.
The Robert Mueller report discovered or announced, despite some very loud headlines, that there was no collusion. And that ultimately...
There was no collusion.
Ultimately, even the issue of meddling, for example, as we know, the hacking of the Democratic National Committee, that later on, Sean Henry, the head of CrowdStrike, the body which looked...
This is disgraceful, isn't it?
...this investigation, not the FBI, actually said there was no evidence of exfiltration.
None.
So all we're saying is...
And we've had Bill Binney, of course, on this programme, former National Security Agency top-ranking guy. That hack came from inside the Democratic Party itself. The Russians didn't do it. This guy is saying as much, and the interference is horrendous. It really is.
Let us look at the evidence. I know that in intelligence work, defence work has to be...
And the interference gets worse, so we'll leave it there. And I'm asking my listeners who understand Morse code, because I bet you every little blip that you hear there, because as he's speaking, you can hear these little dots, these little noises, these plosive sounds, which are breaking up. You know, this... I bet you if somebody who knows Morse code evaluates that, I bet you it's a message from MI6 going, don't come on to our television stations telling the truth, you bastard. I was Richard Sakwa, the only dissenting voice on UK media this afternoon, and, well, it wasn't the best in terms of the sound quality, even though his picture quality was immaculate, didn't distort and didn't break up at all during that conversation. But as I said, dear listener, I don't have any proof he was being interfered with. I just wouldn't put it past them. It is that easy for them to do. You know, what I want you to remember is, those of you who, like myself, you keep an open mind and you think, ah, come on, Baldy, you know, the Russians are no angels. I never said they were. But I want you to keep in mind what the UK media has been telling you now for a number of years. Just remember the Skripal story, eh? Shall we talk about the Skripals again? Yes. The Skripals, Daffy. The Skripal story, here is what we were told. We were told that Russian assassins, this was in Salisbury, former double agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia, allegedly the subject of an assassination attempt by the Russian state. Right? We were told that the assassins painted Novichok on the door handle of the Skripal's house in Salisbury. Right? Right? And at some time, either before they did that or after they did that, they went to the centre of Salisbury and left a sealed container of the Novichok there. That's right. I'm here all week. We were told by Sky News and the BBC that the Skripals touched the door handle and went about their business for the next 4 to 6 hours, even having a drink and a bit of grub before being simultaneously struck down by the nerve agent at a spot in the city centre. Amazingly, at the same location where the alleged assassins left the sealed container of the Novichok. This is what they wanted us to believe. Now, Novichok is supposed to be about 10 times more deadly than sarin or VX gas, but it didn't kill the Skripals. Sky News told us, and UK intelligence agents told us, that the reason it didn't kill them outright was because the rain had washed some of it off the door handle. Yeah, we were told a detective attended the Skripal house was also poisoned, but more likely. And then amazingly, 4 or 5 months, I can't remember, after all of this, two people, Dawn Sturgis and Charlie Rowley, were rummaging around in a local park, looking for cigarette butts, we were told, by the police, and accidentally came into contact with the aforementioned sealed container of Novichok. They were poisoned and allegedly... Dawn Sturgis died a little bit later on. This is the bag of shit that the media regurgitated after swallowing it whole themselves vomited it back up and said to us, you've got to take this. And you're going to say, yummy, yummy. Mad times, mad times. 18 minutes past the hour. And they're telling you today they've got evidence that the Russians doing this and the Russians doing that and the Russians doing the other. But they're not asking for any proof or any evidence. COVID madness. Thanks so much to my pal on Twitter, Chris McGee. How you doing, Chris McGee, for sending this to me? I'll give you Grimesy. This is COVID madness. A man is pulled up next to another car and there's a woman in the other car. She rolls down her window and starts shouting at him and he films her, as is the style of the time. Hilarity ensues. You get that? Guy pulls up. He's close but not too close to another car. She rolls her window down and starts roaring at him, so he films it. And this is, well, beautifully... a beautiful illustration of vaudeville.
Please. Why? I mean it.
Why?
Right?
Why? Why are you going to call the police?
Why are you going to call the police?
You're supposed to keep 2 metres apart because the virus is going on at the moment.
The virus is going on at the moment, so you've got to keep 2 metres apart.
In a car.
Doesn't matter.
I'm in a car.
Doesn't matter.
What are you
on
about?
You haven't got my problem, okay?
I'm in a car.
How come?
Before I put my phone out
and call the police.
What are you
on about? Go on.
I'm calling the police.
What kind of fuckery are you?
Yeah. There's privacy issues at stake there. I'm well aware of it. Everybody is filming everybody these days and humiliating everybody by putting those films on social media. There is a privacy issue. I'm prepared to accept that. But that's the level now. That's what's happened to people. You've got somebody pulling down her car window, shouting at a guy in another sealed car, not hermetically sealed now, but sealed anyway. And she's saying to him, move on or I'm going to call the police because you're supposed to be keeping a 2 metre distance. Thanks to Chris McGee. Thanks to Chris McGee. Nicola Sturgeon addressed the Scottish people this afternoon. Right. Still keeping up the charade. No virus left. Nobody is sick. We're in mid-July. The hospitals are empty. COVID is gone. Herd immunity is amongst us. We are now at a herd immunity stage. But they're still peddling their old fear porn. Here's Jimmy Cranky.
But the key point I want to make to you is this. We all have a part to play in keeping this virus under control. Things like physical distancing, washing hands and surfaces, wearing face coverings, indeed all of the elements of our facts campaign continue to be absolutely crucial. I think we're all conscious of the fact that as life starts to feel a bit more normal than it has done for months, there is a danger that we are all capable of succumbing to, of dropping our guard. But I think we should all stop right now and think about whether that might be true. If we have been dropping our guard and if the evidence of that is there in our own behaviours, and if it is, then all of us should resolve to tighten up again. Remembering all of the basic measures which are summarised in the Facts campaign, they become more and more important as we see more people and have more indoor meetings. So at all times, as you go out and about, please make sure that you avoid creating any bridges that allows the virus to cross from one household.
Avoid creating a bridge. I mean, this is absolute batshit crazy stuff.
So at all times, as you go out and about, please make sure that you avoid creating any bridges that allows the virus to cross from one household into another. If we all do that, we can continue to protect each other and stop the spread of the virus.
Yeah. Jimmy Cranky. 22 minutes past the hour. There's plenty more to do in the news roundup. But you know what? You know what? Let's have a tune. Let's get our first guest on. I fancy, so I do, a little bit of Martha Reeves, but I'm not sure I've got any. I do. I'm delighted now. Welcome to the Richie Allen Radio Show. Tuesday's programme, July 21st. Martha Reeves and the Vandellas on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Not much dancing going on in the streets. The police are breaking up raves all across the country and putting out pictures of rave attendees. So they are asking the question, can the public identify these people? Let's arrest them. How dare they dance and have a good time and then get pissed off when we turn up to break their party. Listening to Nicola Sturgeon there and listening to the Health Secretary Matt Hancock earlier on, there's no end to this. What in the name of God are we going to do, eh?
Enjoy yourself and kill a granny is the answer.
That's the answer, just kill a granny. Now, let's welcome my next guest back to the show. When I say welcome her back to the programme, I mean that when we had the phone in last time out, got to do another one really soon as well, she phoned in to tell me about a new group, a new initiative that she was heavily involved in. And it was very interesting. And I said to her at the time, I said, right, this is really interesting, but let me park it for a bit so I can do the phone in and we'll get you back on the programme. I didn't forget her at all, but I was reminded of her this morning when I saw a video of her addressing the LBC presenter, a guy called James O'Brien, who often gets, well, semi-often gets a mention on this programme. I said, oh, that's Louise. I better arrange for her to come on the programme. The Facebook group, it's got thousands and thousands of members. It's called Save Our Rights UK, A Real Democracy. And I'm delighted to be joined on the programme today by one of the founding members of it, Louise May Creffield. And Louise has been pretty active in the last couple of weeks, taking part in speaking engagements at protests around the country, London, I think. Louise, it's good to talk to you again. How are you?
Hi, Richie. I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm really good, thanks. And I'm glad we finally got a chat. I'm a man of my word, you see. I didn't want anybody thinking that I wasn't being truthful when I said I'd get you back on the programme. I'm very interested in this. And before we talk about that, so you phoned up the James O'Brien LBC radio show. I didn't get a chance to hear it, but I understand that your pretty cogent and relaxed salient arguments didn't go down very well and you were hung up on mid-conversation. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. James had no time and just talked over me and, yeah, eventually hung up on me. And that's not how an open discussion should happen, really. No. I had better success today on talk radio. That was much better. I enjoyed that much more and was able to get my points across and was heard and, yeah, able to put in a valued good piece into the radio show.
Good stuff. I'm glad to hear it.
LBC was not so great.
No, I know you were talking about masks. We might come back to that. So when did Save Our Rights UK come about and how did it come about? What was the catalyst for its creation?
So obviously lockdown came on the 23rd of March and I kind of sat and I watched and I waited and thought, I don't know how I feel about all of this, but I could understand the premise of needing to protect the NHS. Because the NHS has been massively underfunded for the last 10 years and wasn't in any sort of position to deal with pandemics. So while I don't think that we should be held to ransom for the NHS, and I feel like the NHS should have been in a position where it could have dealt with an influx of people, I could kind of understand that argument. However, by the 16th of April, which was the day when they reviewed it, they they'd cancelled all cancer treatment. They'd cancelled all, not all cancer treatment, but a lot of cancer treatment and any non-urgent operations. And they'd shipped all the old people out back into the care homes and they'd built the Nightingale hospitals. And so by the 16th of April, the premise of protecting the NHS was no longer needed. And, you know, we'd achieved that objective. And the NHS hadn't got overwhelmed. So I couldn't see any further need for lockdown to continue, but they did. They went, we're going to extend lockdown. And I thought this just isn't right. And also on that same show, you know, Sir Patrick Vallance, the chief scientific advisor, said it's worth noting that the ONS statistics, death certificates that say COVID on them, doesn't mean that they necessarily had COVID because many of them weren't tested. So, you know, so they extended lockdown. They admitted they were falsifying death certificates. And I was like, this can't happen. So I went and I looked for any groups that were taking action on this, cohesive action on this. And I couldn't find any, what I could find were lots of groups complaining and talking about it and getting together and going, this is not acceptable. But I couldn't find any groups taking action. So that's when I started Save Our Rights.
Really good.
And it was just me and a few friends. And yeah, it's kind of, it's grown since then.
Yeah, it's done very well. On the counting of deaths and on the assigning of COVID to even to those people who had been tested who didn't die, it's got to be mentioned time and time again. The test that they've used in hospitals and still use in hospitals is only able to check for the what we would call the family of coronaviruses rather than the specific COVID, the novel COVID-19 virus. And that's a fact that isn't a conspiracy theory or somebody's conjecture. So even those who are tested today and are told, yeah, you are positive, well, it could be for a previous version of the virus. It stinks to high heaven. Mm-hmm. And before we talk about the group and what you want to do with it, what was your own background then? Were you involved in activism before that? Were you politically active or politically aware?
I have worked in politics for a number of years. And I get involved in political activism as well, but my job is politics. So I know the ins and outs. I know how acts are made. I know how MPs work. I know their full job description. I know how they filibuster acts that they don't like. I know how they, yeah. And so, yeah, I have quite a good insight into how the political system works.
You've had a bit of inside experience. And with what you've just described to me, with Valance admitting that people were being assigned to were people who died were given that certification that they died of COVID, and Valance basically admitted that it didn't necessarily mean that they did. The hospitals weren't overwhelmed, and all of these things were coming together. Mm. What did you think then? Did you begin to think, you know, that this is bad politics or just bad decision making, or maybe something a bit more sinister? Maybe, I mean, I'll give you my tuppence worth on it. I believe it is the state taking advantage of whatever this thing was to introduce the sorts of measures that they could only dream of. I mean, listen to the Irish journalist Kevin Myers last night. So I don't believe it's bad policy. I believe it's something more sinister. What do you think?
Yeah, I know the Tories, you know, and I know politicians. They will power grab at any given opportunity, and what a perfect opportunity just landed in their lap. They're making legislation that they've been trying to make for many, many years. You know, the cuts to child protection services that they've made through statutory instruments of the Coronavirus Act 2020 are ones that they have been trying to put through. And I think they've tried three times in the last few years and it's got voted down. And then along came COVID and they've managed to get it through as a statutory instrument and under the guise of COVID.
So they basically stapled.
You know, these are cutting protections for children in care homes.
Is that right? So they stapled to this coronavirus bill. Basically, I mean, a lot of people won't understand how this works, but they basically added amendments to it that allowed them to make a big change to what you just described to childcare payments. Is that right?
Child protection.
Excuse me, child protection services, not payments. Yeah, is that right? Okay, I wasn't aware of that.
They've made about 100. Statutory instruments, which are, so that's pieces of legislation that don't have to go through the normal process of debate in the House of Commons. And they've made about 100 of these, which has changed over 600 pieces of legislation. This is huge. The amount of laws that they have changed without debate is just of a magnitude that you can't even imagine.
And there's no reporting
and
on it.
These aren't going to reverse. You know, they're not going to go back and change all these back. And, you know, and lots of the Coronavirus Act 2020 is meant to last for 2 years.
Yeah.
There's parts of it that are set to never expire. And the most vulnerable are set to suffer the most from the changes in legislation. It's a big deal. Like, you can't. Yeah, we can't trust the politicians to just deal with this well and not take advantage of the situation.
Louise, it's a major big deal. Have you, so if I know you're maybe reluctant to give the full picture, but how did you, in terms of politics, did you work as a lobbyist for an organisation? Was it in that area, you know, child protective services? Is that where you got into politics?
No, No, I work more directly in politics than that, but I think I'll have to.
Fair enough. You work for an MP or something, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Okay, no worries. We've got Louise, this is important. We've got Louise Creffield on the programme this afternoon, and she's been involved from the get go in a group called Save Our Rights UK, A Real Democracy. They're proposing changes to how politics works in the United Kingdom. Now, I'm fascinated by this. And while I like you, I am going to give you a bit of stick here, right, as we go along. I'm going to leave you plenty of time, right? first of all, before you explain what, you know, the key points, the key things that you think could be changed, I want to put on the record, obviously my listeners know I have no time for any political party, but there was no opposition whatsoever from the Labour Party to what this government has done, including those amendments you mentioned. The Labour Party has been absent in terms of, you know, speaking against the extension of the lockdown and all the rest of that. There's no opposition to it. So tell us about Save Our Rights then, a UK, a real democracy. What sort of practical changes do you think could be made that would make a difference? Over to you.
So the thing that really has to come in is there has to be a stop to any sort of corruption within the system. And so you've got to remember that politicians are often career politicians. They're not here to serve the people. And the whole political setup of governance that we live under today was created by rich and powerful people to keep the rich and powerful rich and powerful. It wasn't set up for me and you. It wasn't set up for your listeners. You know, it was set up to keep the rich and powerful rich and powerful. You know, that's why we have the House of Lords. You know, then they're not here for us, and that's, as far as I'm concerned, a corrupt system. That's not a system of democracy. And we have this one vote every 5 years, which is first past the post as well, and then after that we basically live under a dictatorship. We don't live under a democracy then for the next 5 years. As we've seen, we haven't had any sort of say in what's gone on the last few months, because that's it. We had our vote last year, and that was it. And now we have to suck it up and deal with it until 5 years have passed. And that's not a democracy as far as I'm concerned. So that needs to change. But, you know, we also need to look at other areas of corruption within the system, because, you know, the banking system and tax evasion and, you know, the healthcare system and the judicial system, there's corruption across the board. And you know, you've got to look at the influence of the big corporations, because the problem with the big corporations is once everything is governed by money, really. Let's face it, money is power. And once they became corporations that earned more money through their businesses than the government earned through taxes, they became more powerful than the government. And so they carry a lot of weight and influence a lot of policy. And this it all needs amending.
So would you advocate taking money out of politics entirely? Would you reduce the number? Would you reduce the limit? You know, the monetary limit that any individual or any company can make to an MP or to a party. Would you take it out of politics altogether? Private finance. Would you say
altogether? Yeah.
Nobody gets to give money to an MP to help them get elected or to fund their campaigns. How would we fund them then?
No. There's media, there's social media, like how any other campaign group does it, with people power, you know, people power. That's, you know, the majority, like, while we're not, not kind of party political, you know, the majority of the Labour party's funding comes from the everyday person. You know, anybody can crowdfund, anybody can, you know, if you put forward a good enough argument, you can fund anything, you know. Like, I'm doing all of Save Our Rights just off my own back. You know, I'm a single mum of four, and I'm doing this at the same time as doing that. And if I can do it, I'd say anybody can do it. So it's just a matter of, you know, putting the effort in, putting the hours in. rather than just relying on donors.
Yeah. I'm not saying I don't agree with you. I'm saying they would say, well, okay, well then we should be funded out of taxation, they will say. If that's the case. If all private donations are taken away from the political game, the political system, we'll want to be paid for by the taxpayer, that each party will get, I don't know, a sum of money proportional to their representation in Parliament right now. That will be what they will say, you know, ultimately.
Yeah, and, you know, and maybe that's a system that would be fairer if each candidate got a set amount, you know, once they'd passed the first initial process. To be honest, I'd rather pay it came out of taxes and it'd be a fair and even fight, you know, than it to come out of the pockets of donors and it to be a very weighted fight. You know, there is some pros to it.
We've got Louise Creffield live on the programme. I know there's a lot of interest in this. Save Our Rights UK, A Real Democracy. That's the Facebook page if you want to check it out. You can join the group there and join in. A lot of discussion on these issues. Looking at new ways or alternative ways to govern effectively countries like this one. The country is obviously grotesquely corrupt. The judicial system is horrendously corrupt. There's no two ways about that. Politics is corrupt. When we live in a constitutional monarchy, I don't think a lot of people pay enough attention to that. I think most people are still living under the illusion that that doesn't really matter, that the Crown doesn't really do very much, that it's, you know, it's a figure, head of state, it's a figurehead thing, but it's not. I mean, you talk about politicians not working for us. To enter Parliament, to make speeches, they've got to swear allegiance to the Queen and all her heirs. They're not doing that for the laugh. I mean, that's something to look at as well. What do you say to those listening who, because there will be a lot of Republicans listening, and they will say, I like the sounds of Louise, but what do you say about the Crown? Does the Crown have to go?
Yeah, well, there is no necessity for them, you know, because while, you know, they do have to swear allegiance, you know, it is the work that the Crown does is for show, you know, it's minimal, you know, like everything gets royal assent, like all acts and statutes and laws and stuff get royal assent at the end of the day. But, you know, the Queen hasn't actually interjected and said or done anything to affect change for a very, very long time. And doesn't it is just kind of it's just part of the course rather than an actual kind of, you know, she's never going to step in and protect us from draconian laws, which you'd kind of hope that she would, as she does have more power than
unless
she anybody
approves
else
of them.
In the country.
But unless she approves of them, which might very well be the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but she's not gone against a statute or law for many years. I don't know when the last one was. And if our Queen ever actually has, even. I don't think it's just not a thing that they do anymore, unfortunately. It's just a signed bit of paper these days. But yeah, I think, yeah, people don't recognise that they still hold that power. But, you know, like people don't understand, like the mace holds, you can't pass a law in the House of Parliament without the big old mace.
This is it. Well, you still have a Prime Minister going to a monarch to ask for permission to dissolve Parliament, to ask for permission to have a general election.
Yeah.
You know, I'd have issues with that. One of the things that's interesting, which I liked when I came across some videos on Twitter, because you're on Twitter as well. The group is on Twitter. I'll tweet a link out to it. Louise Creffield is our guest. The Twitter handle is quite simple. It's at Save Our Rights UK. It's all one word, obviously, at Save Our Rights UK. Check it out there and follow it there. Action is obviously important here. You mentioned earlier on, there are thousands of Facebook pages and groups talking about how horrible things are, how draconian things are becoming, and lamenting the fact that nobody is doing anything. But you want to see action. Yeah. You want to see people taken to the streets to demand change. And I know the mask issue is obviously a big deal for you and for everybody else at the moment. Mm-hmm. I know you've been active in speaking out on, on that. So you definitely want to see people get off their backsides, Louise.
Yeah, and this is the crux of it. We need action. You know, if we're going to deal with what we've got, you have to take action. We can't just talk about it, and we can't just join Facebook groups. You know, our Facebook group is wonderful. Like, I love it because we help people take action in the immediate effect. You know, so here's your rights about mask wearing. Here's your rights about track and trace and being tested and stuff. And we've got a lot of really intelligent people in our group that, and we all support each other in that. And we have socials. So we had like a Brighton social and a Manchester social at the weekend, which were well attended. And we're kind of building up communities as well. But yeah, we need to take action. So, you know, yesterday, obviously, a lot of people kind of retweeted and tweeted about James O'Brien and the LBC show, because obviously we believe in a real democracy and therefore having a voice, which we weren't allowed to do yesterday on LBC. And yeah, but we need to take action. So we're planning actions for every Saturday from now on. And these are going to be actions that people can take from home. You know, you don't have to travel anywhere to like a protest or anything. But the whole idea is that we're going to try and get them trending each Saturday on social media and just get the message out that way for now. And at some point we'll need to do, once we've got built up the numbers, then we'll take some more kind of mass actions. But these, we're going to start doing some smaller actions every Saturday. Simon Dolan's going to support us in that. I had a good call with him this morning, and yeah, so we're going to get people used to taking some action, and we'll do it on various issues that have come up in the week prior. And thankfully, you know, issues keep on coming up, so yeah, there'll be plenty of for us to do.
Plenty to do as this has endured in the way it has. Like, it isn't coming to an end. It's becoming more apparent to people that things won't really change dramatically unless a vaccine is presented. Have you noticed that, you know, people who might have been reluctant to criticise what's been happening have become more critical of it and more alarmed by what's happening? I'm noticing that in my own neighbourhood, people whom were happy enough early on, Louise. Yeah, well, look, this is necessary. And I, you know, I've been saying since day one, it wasn't necessary. That was my opinion. I'm seeing them now in a different... They're starting to look a bit more concerned, a bit more alarmed. Are you noticing that?
Yeah, I think, you know, thankfully the government have gone back and forth. And they've just done some really stupid things, you know, like mandating masks 4 months into a pandemic is just the most ludicrous law I've ever heard, you know. And it's making people go, what? Why are we doing that? And so that is helping. The government is helping our cause, thankfully, by doing things like this and by keeping up the pressure and, you know, and locking down Leicestershire and locking down what that whole farm area in Herefordshire.
Yeah.
You know, they're kind of going, and people are going, oh, that's quite, and, you know, giving the power to all local authorities to lock us down whenever you want. You know, for me, I'm quite anxious because my local council leader had been asking for that prior, asking for permission to lock us down further. So I'm quite anxious about that one. So I think the government have made a number of interesting calls, which is waking people up. Yeah, I do agree with that.
And they're not, I mean, this is just my opinion again. You mentioned ludicrous calls. But what if they're not ludicrous decisions? What if they're very carefully thought out decisions? Like you mentioned there, your own local authority. They're allowing local authorities now to access people's private NHS medical data and data that is name identifiable, because they want to know who's been diagnosed with it, who hasn't been, and can we chase people down? And as you just intimated there, not intimated, you stated, and it's true, they've given local authorities now the exclusive and the autonomy, basically, to say, right, we're going to lock down. And I no longer see any of this stuff as silly decisions like mandating masks 4 months into a pandemic. I see it as conditioning people that this is the way things are going to be from now on in.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. But it's confusing enough to get some people to wake up, thankfully.
I hear what you're saying.
I agree that it's well thought out. Because with the giving the powers to the local authorities, you know, Boris is able to stand up there and go, I have opened everything. I've opened gyms. I'm opening this. I've opened it all. And then, you know, but the whole country could be on lockdown next week because the local authorities could lock down. But he can stand there and go, that's not my fault. I opened everything up. You know, it's a very clever move, absolving himself of all responsibility. It's like how they did with the schools. I sat through Simon Dolan's High Court case. I was given permission to sit in on that, which was great. You know, and they were like, no, we didn't close the schools. We just said we need schools to close. But we didn't say that was a legal need. We just said we kind of need that to happen. And then the schools just shut themselves. So they like to absolve themselves of responsibility as well.
You touched on something, Louise. You touched on something very important there for you and your group going forward. You've got to walk a very fine line when it comes to talking to people about what's going on, because while on the one hand, you might strongly suspect that this is part of some plan to make life pretty different in the near future, to give powers to governments that they previously only dreamed of, it's not something that you can take lightly in terms of expressing that to somebody else who might be a bit alarmed. There are a lot of people becoming alarmed, and I'm not going to use the waking up term. People are becoming aware of what's happening, and to jump in there and say, oh yeah, well, this has been part of a plan, you've got to walk a very fine line there with people, don't you?
Yeah, you do. And I talked to this to my group about this, about how to ease people out of comfort zones, because if you go too far out of a comfort zone, you hit panic. And if people get to panic, then they can't hear anything. Even if you've got all the data to back yourself up, if it's too far out of their comfort zone, they won't hear it. So you have to kind of nudge people. But at the same time, what I believe is that actually we don't even necessarily need people to be aware of the full plan. People can think the government are even doing an awesome job this year if they want, but still actually be in favour of a system reform, because this system doesn't work for most people. You know, so I was at Hyde Park the other day, I was chatting to some policemen, and they were like, so tell us what you're here for. And so I kind of did my little spiel, and I was telling them about it. And I said, and, you know, and the system doesn't work for lots of people. Like, if you only have to look over the last few years at WASPI women, Windrush, Grenfell, the nurses' pay cap, you know, how many children are living in poverty. And then I said to the policeman, and, you know, and obviously your pensions and your pension age has been put up. And they went, yeah, it has. And I went, I know. And you can't strike or anything, can you? And they're like, no, but nobody cares about our pensions. And I was like, I know, nobody does really care about police pensions. But, you know, there's something about this system that doesn't work for the majority of people. So even if you kind of, you're not so worried about COVID and you're not so worried about masks and you're not so worried about that sort of stuff, you can still be for a system reform because this system doesn't work for you. So we're going to, as part of our group, is we're going to work with looking at what various demographics need and go, look, you know, this is your need. You know, disabled people have the most horrific time, you know, fighting with the DWP, being told they're fit for work. You know, so many people die each year while waiting for disability benefits and they just don't get them. You know, that can't continue. And so, you know, but those are often people that are shielding, so are quite glad for the measures that have been put in place during this COVID thing, but would actually be fully in favour of a system reform. So our aim is to kind of reach out to people on that sort of basis as well, not just regarding COVID, because, yeah, not everybody is in favour of, you know, not everyone feels the same way that we do.
Were you happy when Jeremy Corbyn took the leadership of the Labour Party? Were you happy to see that happen? Were you optimistic about him at the time? And how do you feel about it now?
I think Jeremy Corbyn, you know, is a hardworking, decent man and who genuinely wanted to work for the people. he was willing to, you know, say like he was willing to follow what came up through Labour conference, even if he didn't necessarily agree with it. You know, that was how he did all of his Brexit stance, was by following what the people said at Labour conference. And he didn't swerve from that, even though there was pressure upon him to do so. And so, you know, I thought he was an honest politician. But sadly, that's never going to work in the current system. You know, honest politicians are never going to, you know, it's not going to work. That's not how you play that game. It's not by being honest and honourable and consistent. You have to fight, and you have to fight dirty. And it's just mudslinging, and it's just not an environment conducive to positive change.
No, it's filthy. It's filthy. Could he have done more for himself in terms of having that platform for that period and getting access to the political television shows that he did? Could he have done a bit better, knowing that it was likely that he wouldn't be there for very long? Might he have done a bit more in terms of some of the things he said at the time?
I think Jeremy's a man, you know, he's a human man who's got, you know, it's a hard job. Being an MP in itself is a full-time job. You know, being the leader of a party is even more pressure. And I believe he did the best he could. But unfortunately, he's in a system that was rigged against him. So it was just never going to bring about the change that anybody could hope for. And that's why, you know, I feel like we need the system to change before we're going to, you know, because lots of people suggested to me to set up a new political party. I'm like, yeah, but that's just playing their game. And it's just never, it will never win. It won't, because, you know, the powers that be and their rich donors would never allow it to, you know. And so, yeah, it's a difficult one. I thought he was great, but I didn't necessarily think that he was actually going to make it, because I know how the system works, unfortunately.
Yeah, he came in for some criticism on this programme. Well, I gave him some criticism, but on the other hand, his brother is a regular visitor to the programme, and I've spoken to him about it privately, and I've said the same thing to him. Maybe he could have used the platform, knowing even that he was doomed to fail. He could have said a bit more, but that's just my opinion. Louise Creffield is our guest. Just got a couple of minutes left. Save Our Rights UK, A Real Democracy, is the Facebook group. I recommend folks you check it out and have a look at it there. The goal is to unite people to take down the archaic and outdated parliamentary model and replace it with a new, radical, truly democratic system. We're going to fight the one big fight, and we will win. Lots of interest. Maybe it's a great time to be doing something like that from your point of view. Where do you think we'll be in 2 or 3 years' time if people don't decide that it's time to get off their backsides and stand up for freedom and for real democracy? If that doesn't happen, where do you think, what would it look like in 2022?
Oh my goodness. Do you know, it doesn't bear thinking about. I actually try not to think about it, because I just have to hope that this is going to be the catalyst for change. You know, I have hope that this is going to be the catalyst for change, because what is people, I don't think, realise what is coming over the next few months. You know, there are going to be so many job losses. People are going to start losing their homes. You know, there's going to be even more draconian measures. There's going to be shutdowns. And then we've also got Brexit to contend with. Like, we can't pretend that Brexit's not happening. Like, it's been shoved out of the news, but Brexit's coming, and we are not getting anywhere with any sort of deal. And people need to recognise, you know, that could lead to food shortages, medicine shortages. You know, what is coming over the next 6 months is going to be catastrophic. I can't see how that will not be the catalyst for change.
You wouldn't accept my argument as somebody who's a dyed-in-the-wool socialist, that however bad the Conservative Party government is or was, the coalition government with the Lib Dems, however bad the Blair Brown government was, that ultimately the European Union project is a political project designed to cede more and more power and more autonomy to Brussels as time goes on, ultimately making, you know, sovereignty a moot point in this country. I would see the European Union as the devil incarnate as an old lefty. I have all the proof in the world to support that. But we know it's becoming a more military integration, more political integration. Corbyn was a lifelong opponent of the European Union, as was Tony Benn, for very good reasons. I'll give you the final word on this, Louise, on the European Union then. It sounds like you're disappointed we're leaving the European Union.
Well, the thing is, it's not whether you're pro or against it, but if, as you say, the European Union is the devil incarnate, they're going to make our life hell for leaving, you know. So whether we stayed and they made our life hell, or we leave, they're going to make our life hell. So it's not about, we are leaving, that's just the fact, and it's going to be hellish. And maybe that's because the European Union are devil incarnate, but they're not going to give us a good deal. They're not going to make it easy, because if they make it easy for us, the rest of the European Union are going to go, oh, well, actually, let's go on out.
But there's a massive trade deficit between the European Union and the United Kingdom. So forget Boris Johnson and his goonish and idiotic mates in Westminster. If I was negotiating for the United Kingdom, I would say, listen, we won't be putting any tariffs on any goods now, because you sell far more in here than we do to you. So if you start playing that game, I will have the French car manufacturers, I will have the German wine manufacturers burn your house down. So don't start with that nonsense. That's what I would say, right? But that's me being.
Yeah, but sadly, you're not Prime Minister, Richie.
Sadly, yeah.
Sadly.
I don't think you'd like it if I was Prime Minister, Louise, to be honest. No, but look, we could go on about the European Union. We might take up European Union and referenda on another day. I'm interested in the project. I really am. Save Our Rights UK, a real democracy. I'm going to give you 60 seconds, Louise, to tell people, a bit of a plug there, do a bit of a promo for you, why they should go to the Facebook page and why they should sign up to the group. Go ahead.
Because there's hope. There's hope and there's a solution, and we have to take action. And if we all join together and we all unite, then the amount of stuff that we can achieve, like the amount of stuff that I achieved in the last few months, is phenomenal. And that started with just me, and we're now at over 8,500 people, and it's growing. Like, we've had over 2,000 people join in the last week, and it's just been massive. And if we carry on at that sort of rate, we can actually enact change, and then we won't have to be fighting these fights. We won't have to fight about masks. We won't have to fight about this, because we'd have a real democracy where we had a voice, and we'd have mechanisms that would say no. And we'd also take out all corruption, so that actually what was going on in this country was for the people. And that is what's got to be, you know, this country has to be run for the people, not for anybody else, not for the corporations, not for anything like that. It's got to be run for the people. And that's what we've been lacking. We, you know, we haven't had a real democracy ever in this country. It was set up by the rich and powerful. But we can do something about it if we join together, and if we unite and we put aside our differences, you know, about anything else that we've got, you know, that's the EU or left and right or what have you. You have to put those aside, because right now we have to unite, because what is coming is more and more draconian laws. And if we do not galvanize now, then we're going to end up at crisis point. And I don't want to get to that point. I don't want to get to those crisis points. I want to start taking action now and saying, no, we're not going to accept any of that. So it's not, you don't even bother trying to bring it in. So there's hope. That's what I'd suggest, is that there's hope and there's a solution, and we're working really hard on a solution, and we're working hard on enacting that solution. And we've got plans, and we're open to all voices, and we have like regular group Zoom calls and talks and discussions. And it's also just a great community to be part of. And we link people up with people in their local areas, so you can get together and have socials. And so we can also support each other. So if a local area gets put on a local lockdown, there are going to be people that can help each other through that as well. So there's a lot of benefits to joining us. So I'd really encourage as many people to as possible. And they can also follow on Twitter, but most of the action is on Facebook.
Well, I've enjoyed chatting with you, Louise. You'll have plenty to do with four children as well. I think you said to me four children earlier on. So I've enjoyed chatting to you today. Folks, again, Louise Creffield, go to the Save Our Rights UK / A Real Democracy. It's a private group on Facebook, but you can just click, press join group, and an admin will be in touch with you and we'll sort that out for you. Thanks for your time today, Louise, and I wish you Godspeed.
Thanks so much, Richie.
Not
Have
at all.
Good evening.
You too, and I'm sure we'll talk again in the near future. Louise Creffield there, Save Our Rights UK, A Real Democracy, is the Facebook page. And there is a lot of interest in it, an enormous amount of interest in it in the last couple of weeks. You mentioned Simon Dolan there, the businessman. Simon will return to this programme tomorrow afternoon. That's Wednesday. Tomorrow afternoon, Wednesday. We need to do headlines now. We need to do headlines. So it's over to FSN for headlines. Tuesday's Richie Allen Radio Show, the 21st of July. A lovely afternoon here in Salford.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. A British parliamentary committee says Russia interfered in Britain's 2016 Brexit referendum and says the government didn't want to investigate it. The European Union has struck a deal to provide support for the economies of the 27-member bloc. It's worth 750 billion euros. And President Trump will host the first in a new series of coronavirus briefings from the White House
later
today.
Thank you very much. Sorry, Simon. Thank you, Simon, for that. Coming up for 6 minutes past the hour, Matt O'Connor from Fathers for Justice will join me in a few minutes' time. You do not want to miss that. It's been a long, long, long time since I spoke with Matt. I reckon about 4 years ago now. A very interesting campaign, very interesting poster on display, Fathers for Justice, outside the Johnny Depp Sun libel case in London yesterday afternoon. That's coming up in a couple of minutes. I'll be back with you in 60 seconds.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbajerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Welcome back to the programme. It is, what time is it now? It's 7.5 minutes past the hour. Thanks for your tweets. You can tweet the programme. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. That never changes. Do get in touch with me. Always like reading your comments. Hi to Donkey OT, the left hand of God. Stuart, how you doing? Anything you like. Lots and lots. Hi to Chris Morell. Chris said the way Corbyn voted, what he said in Labour speeches and the motions he tabled bear out that he did raise the issues we wanted him to. Syria, Venezuela, Assange, Salisbury. Time after time, he was smeared, marginalised and squashed out by the bullshit, says Chris. Thank you, Chris. I appreciate that. Hi to Charlie Girl. Hi to Faisal. Faisal tweets, ultimately, we do not know what pressures were brought to bear on Corbyn, including threats of death and torture from intelligence or criminal agencies. Who really knows if he was a shill or an honest politician? Thanks, Faisal. I would have never called him, and I never did call him a shill. I basically said, I said lots of things. We don't have time for me to get into it. But I said from day one he would do and would achieve nothing. I said from day one that when he was interviewed live by Sky and BBC that he would never aggressively take on the interviewers and the reporters and go after them on issues around Palestine and things like that. And it was borne out that I was right to say that. And that's about it, really. Look, we'll take a tune when we come back from that. Fathers for Justice, Matt O'Connor, is on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Okay, okay. Music from Tom Petty then. Tuesday afternoon.
We'll beat you down.
Right, music from Tom Petty on the Richie Allen Radio Show. 11.5 minutes past the hour. Tuesday evening. It's a lovely evening here in Salford. It's been a bit miserable last few days. Nice this evening, though. Let's get into it then with Matt O'Connor. Now, Fathers for Justice yesterday afternoon parked a mobile campaign advert outside the Royal Courts of Justice, where Johnny Depp's libel case against The Sun is being heard. The campaign advert had the slogan "Ditch the Witch" on it. The group, of course, are well known for their stunts. Matt himself dressing as Batman scaling Buckingham Palace. The stunt yesterday is part of the launch of a campaign for divorce reform. And I'm delighted, after a long absence, I can't believe it, to welcome back to the programme my old pal, Matt O'Connor. Jesus, Matt, was back in my Spain days we began talking. How are you?
Richie, my brother, how are you, sir?
I'm really well, but I'm going to give you loads and loads of stick. You misogynistic bastard. What's this ditch the witch thing? You don't know what's going on in that libel trial. Who's in the right and who's in the wrong. I've my female listeners genuinely tweeting saying, come on, that's a bit outrageous.
It is a bit outrageous, but it was approved by women. We road tested it. My wife approved it. She was there yesterday. You know, and I think what we're saying is, look, you know, it's a slightly inflammatory headline to get attention. We're in the Times today. We're in the Independent today. I think we're on Good Morning Britain today. And it's certainly got attention. But the point is a very serious point here. And we campaign, as everybody knows, for parental equality, to give fathers equal rights in law to see their children. And we're campaigning for divorce equality and to end the assumption that ex-wife should have lifelong spousal maintenance, right? A license to bill for life to rely and be financially dependent on a man. In an age of equality, you know, it's outrageous that women can think or should think that just because you get divorced, you can keep taking and taking and taking. And it's like a bride, it's like a gold digger's charter. It's like greedy bride dealers tucking in to the bank of the man, when in reality they should be standing on their own two feet after divorce. So we've got to stop that. We've got to end that. And we do need this very, very important principle of divorce equality to be established.
Most women I've met, my parents split up when I was 15. And yeah. So I have a dog in this fight. Most women I've spoken to over the years, they just want their husband or their ex-husband to do his bit in providing for the raising of their child or children. And most women I've met are not looking to see, or they don't see their husbands as some sort of never-ending cash cow. And they'd be offended by your characterisation of gold diggers. It's like, well, you know, the marriage is ended. We've got kids here. You've got to do your bit, son. And lots of fathers don't do their bit.
Well, I think that's a bit of an old stereotype there, Richie, if I might say so. Firstly, let's just look at the facts. Well, I'm afraid there are a lot of gold diggers out there. You can start off with Heather Mills McCartney, to name one. You can start off with the fact that one in six of all divorce cases heard in the courts of England involve foreign nationals, women who come to England to get divorced simply because the payouts are so incredibly generous. And I think it's also really harmful to marriage, because if you look at it, I think in terms of millennials, you know, less than half of all millennials are now thinking about getting married. I think a lot of people now recognise that marriage for men is a trap. It's a man trap. It's bad for them. A lot of people don't want to be stuck in toxic relationships. And we talked about Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. That's the best advert for divorce in the world. And I think what we're saying, all we're saying is, let's not reduce men to the status of cash points. Let's not reduce men to the status of sperm banks. A lot of women want to take the money, but they don't want to see the dad involved in the lives of their children. That's why we've got 3 million kids living in fatherless homes. So there's a huge, huge problem. And all we're saying, and surely nobody could disagree with this, is that we should have parental equality and we should have divorce equality. What is wrong with that?
Well, let's talk about divorce equality and parental equality forensically in a moment. But I can't believe a guy of your intelligence, and I have a lot of time for you, as you well know, I can't believe a guy as bright as you is going to bring up Heather Mills McCartney. Who could feel sorry? Who could feel sorry for any bloke if he's done over by somebody who has set out to, you know, entrap him in that way? Number one. And number two, What about prenuptial agreements? Why are you painting men as some sort of victims in all of this? Isn't it clever, or wouldn't it be more clever in this day and age, that if you're a successful man and you're in love with a woman, you know, that you say, right, we're getting married, darling, or whatever, but we're going to have a prenup. What's wrong with a prenup?
Well, they're not legally binding. That's the problem. They're not recognised in law as being legally binding. You can have all the prenups you want, but if it's not recognised by the court may well take it into account that it is not legally binding. And I would support the introduction of prenups. I mean, it'd be a very intelligent thing to do. But again, you know, that's another part of the reform of the divorce laws that is required. I mean, at the moment, the government proposals here are going to make it introduce no-fault divorce. All that's going to do is make it easier for people to get divorced. What a lot of fathers think is when they get divorced, you know, they think, oh, I've got rights to see the children. No, you have no rights to see the children even after you divorce, because children's proceedings are entirely separate to divorce proceedings. It is a scam, Richie. It is a scam. It's what we call, I don't know if you remember, my family from Kerry. And we had a very good family priest of my father, Jim, over there in Killarney, God bless him. And he talked to me about the three rings of marriage. You've got the engagement ring with the wedding ring, and then you've got the suffering. Right. And let me tell you, as advice goes from a family priest, I thought it was great advice. And I think it is important that we look and go say, look, let's do this intelligently. Let's stop this, you know, do it sensibly. Because I think a lot of men go with the ride. They go, oh, I've got to pay her this, and I've got to give her that, and I've got, you know, do this. And it's a sort of, we go back, we revert back to the Sir Galahad syndrome, you know, this principle of chivalry. We're going to be chivalrous. We're going to lay our cape in the puddle. We're going to give her this. We're going to give her the house. I'm going to give her that. I've done it. It's madness. It's insanity. You're giving away hard-earned personal wealth. Often the wife may have done nothing. She may have contributed in some way, and we say it shouldn't be fair. You know, it should be fair, it should be equitable, but it is insane that you have, after you divorce, you are still giving money to your ex-wife, that your ex-wife can come back for a second bite of the cherry, to double dip, to go back to the cash point of her ex-husband and keep making withdrawals. It's madness, Richie.
Now,
it's wrong.
First of all, that priest in Ireland, if he's still, he should be defrocked.
He's still in business.
He should be defrocked.
He's still in business.
That's not Catholicism, as I know it. All joking aside, though, I've heard people say the proposed no-fault divorce law will actually make it easier for people financially, because it's going to, you know, help people avoid the obviously very costly proceedings that people end up getting into. But you reckon that the no-fault divorce law will make it easier for fathers to be removed from their families. How do you reckon that to be true?
Well, firstly, solicitors welcome no-fault divorce laws. They're not welcoming it because it means less business for them. They're welcoming it because they know it means more business for them, right? So no-fault divorce is good for lawyers, but legal business, bad for dads and terrible for children. And the problem is, all it is going to do is going to drive warring parents out of the divorce courts into the family courts, which I can tell you now are in meltdown, where they're digging judges up out of the graveyards as I speak, where the hearings they're listing now are not going to be heard until 2021 at the earliest because of the backlog, down to COVID, down to court cuts, down to number of litigants in person, dads representing themselves, going into the court system. The court system is at breaking point, it's a meltdown. So all you're going to do is drive these cases into the family courts. So it is absolutely critical that these no-fault divorce laws are not brought in. It will not make the situation better. It will make it even worse than what it is at the moment. And that's our expert objective view. And I say that we are in court every single day. At the moment, it's all telephone hearings. There's no in-person hearings because of COVID. But we're in court every day doing 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 hearings a day, speaking to judges, dealing with fathers, helping dads trying to get access to the kids. So we have, you know, unrivaled knowledge and expertise in terms of dealing with the family justice system. And I also have the you know, unpleasurable task of speaking to dads who've agreed divorces, who've given the ex-wife a house for the kids to live in, because it's assumed automatically that the children should live with the mother, which in itself is an outrage. Why can't they live between the mother and the father? But the mother gets the house, the mother gets the kids, the mother gets the cash, and then he says, oh, she stopped me seeing the kids, what can I do?
And I don't think, Matt, sorry to interrupt you.
You've got divorced.
I don't think it's the worst thing in the world that a parent gets the lion's share of custody. Let me explain that. I think it would be my opinion, only my opinion, it's not based on any evidence, that children spending half time with dad and half time with mum, I think it would be disruptive for children. And ultimately, and you can call me old-fashioned if you want for the second time, I deserve it, you can call me what you want, I ultimately believe that if mum is fundamentally decent, it's better they spend most of their time with mum and dad sees them at weekends and in holidays. So long as mum is fundamentally decent, that's how I would prefer things to be. And again, I'm not basing that on any scientific evidence. I just think it makes more sense for the maternal to be with the children more.
Richie, this is 2020. Yeah, it's not 1820. Yeah. Right. We have progressed a little bit since when men were down mines and plowing, you know, toiling in fields and stuff. You know, a third of all childcare is undertaken by fathers. I mean, that's a kind of this prehistoric Stone Age thinking that belongs in the Stone Age, I'm afraid. I mean, this is the 21st century, when we hopefully move.
But a lot of people would agree with me. You might say, and listen, I've known you a long time, and I've got as thick a skin as you have. You can say what you want about my opinion, but I know a lot of people share that opinion. And I'm not talking about conservative Christians either. I'm talking about people that I would meet and interact with.
I don't know anybody who holds that view. I mean, you know, if I went to the rest of Ireland, you know, people's opinions and views are different. But look, I mean, I think we want to be progressive. If we have an age of equality and we live in an age of equality, and Ireland, I mean, you know, I go back to the Falls Island all the time. I lived over there for large chunks of my life, and they proclaimed to be a country of equality, and yet there's no equality for fathers, and somehow that is acceptable. I don't understand why we have equality for everybody apart from dads.
Let me put this to you.
I don't understand it.
We've got Matt O'Connor from Fathers for Justice on the programme. This is a very important issue, this. Mandu Reid from the Women's Equality Party said that Fathers for Justice, its patronising recommendation that women should be encouraged to be financially independent, assumes a level playing field and ignores the fact that many fathers are simply not willing to share the load and provide 50% of the practical and financial support that their children need. And finally, she says the reality is women are far more likely to take on the burden of childcare than men before and after separation, with women accounting for 90% of single parents. Meanwhile, women earn significantly less than men due to the gender pay gap, which widens to a staggering 33% for new mothers over the 12 years following their return to work from maternity leave. Now, that last bit is factually correct. She's making some good points there.
Well, I'd say one thing. She's well balanced. She's got a chip on both shoulders there. And I think, you know, I don't think it's a very intelligent argument to say that mothers bear the cost of childcare or the time of childcare when so many mothers deny dads access to their children. And what we're saying is that the presumption of 50-50 share care that we campaign for is absolutely right. Why wouldn't you want to share the care of your children? You reduce the burden of cost of childcare, you reduce the burden on the taxpayer, you get better outcomes for children, better outcomes for families, better outcomes for the mothers and the fathers. The mothers who benefit from share care arrangements that we campaign for have time to develop their own careers, they have time to start their own businesses, and it is a proven in many US states and parts of the world like Sweden that these have absolutely positive benefits for children, for families, and for our country as a whole. And it's about sharing that burden. Absolutely. Loving dads who want to be responsible parents, not reduced to cash points, not reduced to sperm banks, but want to contribute financially. But child support is also about emotional support. So making sure the children retain the love and care and the best of both their parents. And I found it pretty sickening to hear the Women's Equality Party, who is a bit like Animal Farm, Richie, you know, some animals are more equal than others. And they have a view on it which is pretty bigoted, which is pretty sexist. If it was the other way around, then let me throw this line in here. Let's reverse the presumption. Let's assume that instead of saying 97% of residencies are given to mothers, let's say 97% of residencies were given to fathers, and we would declare that 97% of mothers were unfit to share in the care of their children. There would be outrage. There would be outrage. And that is the test here, is how we treat one gender against the other gender. And I don't want to raise my three boys, 24, 23 and 14, who naturally also have, not unsurprisingly, strong views on this matter, but they want to be treated, right, not on the basis of their gender, but on the basis of who they are as individuals. And I think that is the same with religion. I think the same with race. That's all we're asking. It is a small ask.
Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this.
It's a huge struggle. It's a huge struggle.
This is really important. I know you're busy, and I know our time is finite today, but I want to ask you this. I've been doing this program for a number of years, and it's independent, and we get to talk about things that they don't talk about on the mainstream media. And I've encountered something I find very disturbing. And I'd love you to be involved in looking into it. I'd love you to homogenise Fathers for Justice and call it Parents for Justice. I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. Because I meet a lot of women in this country who lose access. Now, a lot of these women are single parents who lose access to their children, not because of anything necessarily some man did, but because social services and the secret family court, right, determined that mum had a bit of psychological illness back in the day and she might be a danger. And they use these horrible terms like future emotional harm. And I'm going to say something else to you. I know you won't like this. But I've spoken to some women. One of them is a very high profile case where they found that sexual abuse was a real thing. It was really going on. And when this was brought to the attention of the authorities, everybody lost access to the child immediately, including the mother. The family court system seems to be completely bent and it completely, you know, failing in its duty to do right by parents, both men and women. I see a lot of women suffering and they've nowhere to go. The papers are not allowed to report on these things. I know you know all about this because you see it from the other side, from fathers. I think parents...
Well, no, I see it, but I can just say, Richard, I do see both sides. I see both sides a lot of the time, and I know a lot of horrific cases involving mothers who've been cruelly separated from their children by social services. I've seen it a lot. I've had female friends who've been through it, who've come to me for help and advice and support, which I freely give, right? So this is not entirely one-way street. But what I would say about the Fathers for Justice here, and what I will always say, is that I'm a father. It's my story. I started it 20 years ago. Next year, I'm the father of three boys who will also probably become fathers. And so it does what it says on the tin. I didn't call it parent parity. I didn't put your foot around. I did because it's my story and it's where the majority of prejudice is. That isn't to say other people are not unfairly treated, women are not unfairly treated or discriminated against. Of course they are. But there are a lot of support groups out there for those people. But, you know, we have been involved in cases involving women, and you know, we are principally about equal justice. That's what we campaign for. And let me tell you, you know, my wife has been involved in Fathers for Justice. She helped take the national lottery off air in front of 11 million people in 2006.
I remember.
A third of our supporters are women. So we can't do this without women, fathers, mothers, sisters, brothers, coming together in unity to find a solution to a common problem and in common cause, so we can get better outcomes for our children.
Final question, Matt.
Most logical. Sorry?
I was just going to say, final question.
Of course.
Christopher Booker, of course, and Sue Reid and the Daily Mail, but generally journalists don't want to touch the family court system. The family court system, I believe, in this country, and I know some judges involved in it have had ties to charities that find that find homes for children as well, that put children in foster care. The family court system would appear to me, and I am looking at it from the female point of view because it's mostly women I hear from. It looks to me like something that would make the North Koreans look like saints. How bad is it, Matt, and what can be done about it?
Oh, it's dysfunctional, it's cruel, it's abusive. It is the biggest child abuse scandal in the history of this country. And I get mocked. I was mocked in The Guardian. I did a piece of The Guardian interview a couple of years ago, and he mocks me because I said it was the biggest child abuse scandal in this country. I am confident it will be proven as such in maybe not in the next 5 years, maybe not in the next 10 years, but like Hillsborough, it could be 26 years before this issue is dealt with. But it is fundamentally abusive. It is not fit for purpose. It is completely secretive. It's the devil's labyrinth. When you get stuck in and trapped inside the system, you don't get out. You've got an unelected, unaccountable, unsackable judiciary operating in complete secrecy. It is a disgrace. It is an anathema to any modern democracy and should be ended. And what we need, Rich, is courts are for criminals. They're not for families. They're not for warring parents. Legalized cage fighting, which is what it is, needs to be stopped. We need to have better solutions. And that is why I will, to my dying breath, always campaign for the presumption of 50-50 shared parenting, because the best parent for a child is always both parents in most cases.
But before,
and that's my opinion.
Listen, I respect you for it. I respect your campaigns, and we've spoken many times in the past, it must be said, about these issues. Just a couple of things finally. I have had a couple of solicitors on this programme in the past. One of them, and an academic who qualified as who got a degree in law but went to France, where he does a lot of work for women, a guy called Ian Josephs. Many people are of the belief that the system is so sinister that it's actually about money, because hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds a year are made foster care. So again, puts North Korea, it makes sense of North Korea. Charlotte has been on to say she's interested in hearing you, doesn't entirely agree with your views. So I'll give you the final word on this. Matt seems to deny that single mothers suffer disproportionate financial hardship. Plenty of fathers won't support the kids, while some or many do, she says. It should be judged on a case-by-case basis. Gold digger is a stereotype also. So you do have the final word. I won't interrupt you, and I won't editorialise after that. Matt, final word to you, and thanks for coming on.
Richie, it's been a pleasure. All I'd say is what we want to see is mothers and fathers acting reasonably and responsibly and recognising child support is about emotional support as much as financial support. And that if we have genuine 50-50 share care, genuine 50-50 division of child benefits, genuine divorce equality, these principles can only lead to better outcomes for our children, for our families and for our country. And that is our objective.
Cheers, Matt. Great to talk to you again. It's been ages. I
hope
it won't be so
Richie.
Long. You
Take
too.
Care.
All
Take
the best
care.
For now. Matt O'Connor, who founded Fathers for Justice, there on the line from his home in London. Yeah. Well, you heard him say there, you heard him describe very succinctly what he feels about the family court system. You heard him describe or accept the contention that hundreds of millions of pounds are being made by adoption agencies every year, and that there is corruption within the system. The children are being taken because there is a huge price on the head of that child. That child is worth a fortune to the adoption agencies, who then go on to place them with foster families. I know a lot of our female listeners won't be thrilled about what they heard there, but I challenged every bit of it, and I said before and I say it again, for me, what I see going on today more than anything is women having their children taken on the basis that they represent some risk of future emotional harm to their child. In other words, a child being taken from its mother for no reason in a secret court situation with no media scrutiny whatsoever, with nobody there to report on it and to say this is a scandal. And we've heard from many of these women over the years. I don't have to mention their names. You know who they are. I'm sure Sharon Gale is listening. I'm sure Samantha Baldwin will listen or grab the repeat of this or grab the podcast later on But I like Matt O'Connor. He's a decent guy. Interesting stunt that was yesterday. I'm going to take some music. When we come back, I've got some more news for you. A little bit more news for you. This is Stevie Wonder. Who else? The song is called Higher Ground. Tuesday's Richie Allen Show. 24 minutes to the top of the hour.
Thanks to you, The Richie Allen Show is the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. Show your support for this unique broadcaster by making a regular financial contribution. Just the price of a cup of coffee each month will make a massive difference. Visit richieallen.co.uk for details.
Welcome back to The Richie Allen Radio Show Tuesday. It's Tuesday. It is indeed. Where's the summer, eh? It's nice and pleasant, actually, this afternoon here in the lovely Salford. Let me tell you a quick story. Now, I had a wonderful and a fairly surreal experience this afternoon. So around about 2 o'clock, I took the doggies, both of them, to the field for their afternoon run, which is basically me throwing a couple of tennis balls for them to run around like lunatics until they're too tired to run anymore, and then they come home. That's how it goes. Any dog owners, they know this is how it goes. Anyway, the field I go to in the afternoon is most often empty. It's very underused. But today, there was a bit of activity there. So I'm walking around, and there were two young kids kicking a football. And they were black kids. And as we're walking towards them, it's a big old field, and I walk the perimeter of it. And these lads had put down their own little cones, their little training aids, and they were doing drills, which I was interested in, as a former football coach now, with no qualifications whatsoever. I used to coach for Hibernian FC in Waterford City with under-11s and under-12s and under-16s later on, and enjoyed it. But I didn't have any formal qualifications. I just had a basic knowledge of the game. In fact, I was clever. Your BBG was quite clever. What I used to do was, our local professional football team, Waterford United, I used to get some of the professionals or semi-professionals to come along and introduce drills and training measures that I would basically learn from. Yeah, I wasn't born yesterday. Anyway, I loved it. So I see the kids today kicking a ball. And of course, our golden retriever dog, Leia, is 8 months old, so very difficult to control. So she rushed towards the lads playing football, which can be a bit of a nuisance. And I shouted ahead to the lads, "Don't worry, lads, I'm sure she doesn't have the bite diameter or the bite circumference to destroy that size 5 ball. Don't worry about it." Anyway, one of the kids, the older kid, came running up to me and he said, "Are you Irish?" in a bit of an Irish accent. And I said, "I am. I'm from Waterford. Where are you from?" He said, "I'm from Mullingar." And I said, "Lovely." I said, "How long have you been here?" And he said, We've been here for a short while. I was on the books of Manchester United, and now I'm on the books of Oxford United. My family are over here, but they're moving back to Ireland." And I said, "Where do your parents originally come from?" And they said, "Nigeria." The older boy, his name is Kevin, and the younger boy's name is David. Kevin is 17, David is 13, and they were in their mannerisms, in the way they spoke, in their friendliness, in their jocular behaviour, they were as Irish as anybody I've ever met. And that got me thinking. I had a lovely conversation with them, really lovely. And they were telling me about what they were going to be doing, and apparently they're going, the older kid, Kevin, is going to stay and hopefully make a career in professional football. He's playing for Oxford United youth team at the moment. Centre half, he's doing well. And young David, 13 or 14, still in school, but looks to have some talent as a footballer as well. But it got me thinking, and you know, as long as you've listened to me, I've never tried to score points with anybody or virtue signal with anybody. And I do have some guests on the programme, and they are conservative Christians, and some of them are right-wing in their thinking, and I don't judge them, I enjoy listening to them. And many of them would express grave concern about Ireland losing its culture because of immigration. Now, I would be the first to admit that Ireland has done a lot more, far more, and has had to bear the burden of more migration than a lot of other European countries for a number of years. And I saw this myself when I was based in Waterford. I was born and bred in Waterford, worked for WLRFM in Waterford. And I saw when there was a big influx of asylum seekers and migrant workers into the city. I saw that it was a problem for some people. And again, back then, luckily enough, for all my faults, I've never played the race card. And I don't believe that people are fundamentally racist when they raise concerns about these things. I don't believe that just because you ask questions about these things, it means that you're bigoted in any way. But the whole thing about culture, like I said, these two lads couldn't be any more Irish, right? These two young black kids, lovely lads. I was so glad I met them. It made my day, not because they're black, but because they're Irish. And they approached me and they asked me about, and they were very interested in me. And I said to Kevin, I said, Kevin, if Nigeria or Ireland come knocking in the future, and without missing a beat, he said, Ireland, I'd play for Ireland because I'm Irish. Have you been back to, not back to, but have you visited Nigeria? And he said, I went when I was very young with my dad, but I have no memory of it. I said, would you like to? Ah, maybe I wouldn't, he said. Right. And I thought, right. But these are kids who grew up in Mullingar, in the Midlands in Ireland. And like I said, are as Irish as me. And I wonder, again, not to use puns, not to be a punner or to resort to punning. But these things are not black and white, are they? These issues. And that's what occurred to me this afternoon, meeting those two lads, proudly proclaiming themselves to be Irish. And knowing that if there were certain other people hearing them proclaim themselves to be Irish, that they wouldn't be very happy about it at all. At all, at all, at all, as we say back home in Ireland. But yet I'm quite happy. Not because I'm a Marxist or I'm, you know, a Frankfurt School devotee or any of that old crap. Not because I've got any time for open societies, which I don't, or any of that crap. But I'm happy that the lads are Irish. Right? I just thought I'd mention that. It's a very interesting thing today. And if they're listening, the lads, and they might very well be, I enjoyed meeting you, and the very best of luck going forward. This week, a government report was published that suggested 200,000 excess deaths might be expected as a result of the lockdown. Number of reasons for the 200,000. People who didn't have essential treatment when they desperately needed essential treatment. Okay? Addiction issues, mental health problems, and so on, so on, so on. 200,000. To date, the government claims that just over 46,000 people have died of coronavirus. But we know that that is horse manure. We know this. We know it is a nonsense. By their own admission, it is a nonsense that 46,000 people have died of coronavirus. I explained why earlier on. The test itself is completely and utterly useless because it tests for the whole gamut of coronaviruses and doesn't isolate the novel coronavirus 19. It doesn't. So it is bull spit, writ large. It might only be a handful. It might only be a couple of thousand people, really, in reality, that actually died from exposure to coronavirus 19. And again, you've got to ask about the medical condition of those people, their immune system, the suppression of it, and so on, so on, so on, so on, so on, so on. 200,000. Well, it's a big problem. We're going to hear from the Ginger Ninja. And I'm glad I caught this morning because this is a big problem. And I know this because I found it all too easy myself. All too easy. At weekends, with venues closed, with places closed, with, you know, through the very early and the middle part and most of the lockdown, access to town centres, access to shops, access to places to go, museums, cinemas and all the rest of it. I know myself, it has been far too easy to pick up a drink. And I have drunk more during this period than I've ever done before. To the point where I've taken steps now to address that, right? And I know a lot of other people, people whom I know personally, have found the same thing. Well, most news outlets today went with a new study, a new survey which suggests that drinking in lockdown is going to be a huge problem going forward. Here's Kay Burley on Sky News this morning.
Lockdown has led to a surge in drink-related problems, with alcohol sales soaring and doctors saying they expect a spike in alcohol-related ill health. That's according to a poll commissioned by the Addiction Helpline Help for Addiction, which suggests 4 in 10 households are drinking more than before. Let's speak to Nick Conn. He is the Chief Executive of Help for Addiction. Hello to you. Thanks for joining us on the programme this morning. What is the extent of the increase during lockdown? Just how bad was it?
So, I mean, we conducted this survey on the, you know, on the back of a huge increase of inquiries and phone calls coming through to us. And, you know, it looks like 60% or 59% of people are increased their drinking. And it's becoming quite concerning.
Who's it impacting?
It's actually the figures state that females were showing quite a huge increase. But on top of that,
I've heard this as well now from multiple sources that women are succumbing in great numbers to alcohol, to drinking far more alcohol than they ever would. And listen to what he says next.
On top of that, 60% of the figures were parents. So we're seeing a big increase in parents, which obviously can potentially have a safeguarding issue, you know, safeguarding risks as well.
So I'm guessing the main reasons then, given extrapolating from what you're saying there, is that people are sort of using alcohol to relax at the end of a busy day with the kids at home.
No, it's far deeper than that, Kay. Kay's not very bright, you see.
It's at home.
I think with homeschooling, with the additional mess. I know my wife was looking forward to me going back to work. But with everything going on, the stress, you know, the thing is, the drink is not somebody's problem. The drink is somebody's solution. Now, whether they use that to relax at the end of a hard day or whether they're using that to escape from something more.
Escape from something more.
You know, there's so many different driving factors to this.
Yeah.
What we did, Burley doesn't get it because she's as thick as two planks of wood placed side by side. What's happened is, and I see this in people around Salford specifically because this is where I live, that people have been terrified. They have been terrified beyond anything they could have ever previously imagined by this whole fake COVID scare. Terrified by it. Terrified by the fact that they were told to stay in their homes, that they couldn't go and see their grandparents and bring their children to see their grandmother and grandfather. Terrified by having to deal with their children, whom were becoming more and more terrified themselves because of their exposure to the constant fear porn on the news. The stress built and built and built. Furloughed, 80% of your wages paid by the government. You knew that there was a good chance that when this all ended that you wouldn't have a job. You've got a mortgage. You've got maybe a few hundred pounds in the bank if you're lucky. People had never experienced this before. Horrendous. So people have turned to the bottle in large numbers. And people who drank moderately, traditionally, who wouldn't drink in the week and would have a drink on Saturday or maybe on Sunday with dinner, or go and meet some mates in a wine bar in town and have two or three glasses of wine. Now people are drinking a bottle of wine every evening. Or they're buying a half bottle of spirits every evening. I talked to my local shopkeeper about this the other day. My local shopkeeper, whose name is Mo. And I said, tell me about the sales of alcohol during the coronavirus thing. And he said, several 100% increase. Tell me about women. He said, far more women than ever before coming in to buy alcohol, to go home and to drink it. And the legacy of that, I think, will be borne out over time. What it will mean for people, for people's lives, for their lifespans, but also for the National Health Service in this country. Jason has just tweeted me. I once read, he says, Richie, that during the meltdown in Russia in the Yeltsin years and just after, the life expectancy for the average male was 56 due to alcoholism in that country. Says Jason. Yeah. Yeah. Staggering that. So we're going to lock down the country. We're going to shut the economy down. We're going to close businesses right across the UK. We're going to put a financial burden on the country, which has yet to be realised by most people, by borrowing from the Bank of England and from other sources. They've not just borrowed from the Bank of England. They've sold government bonds to the private sector. You're talking billions upon billions upon billions of pounds to pay for the shutdown of the economy, to pay for the furlough scheme. It's not free money. It has to be paid back with interest. Massive unemployment coming. People can see that. They're stressed to hell with it. They've never, ever seen anything like it. They know something is very dark and sinister about it, but they can't put their fingers on it. They turn to alcohol. Or they turn to drugs. Hard drugs. All of this stuff going on underneath the surface. And you've got the Health Secretary and the Director of the Wellcome Trust, which is linked to Bill Gates, Professor Sir Jeremy Farrar, telling people that the UK will be living with coronavirus for years and years to come today. Since I've been on air, this guy Jeremy Farrar, hugely influential. He's a member of the Scientific Advisory Group, SAGE. This guy advises the government. These guys are telling you, we'll be living with this for years to come. Even if a vaccine comes, we'll still be living with it for years to come. Jean Anna's message has sent me a message there about poverty. Again, it's unimaginable. I used to do financial reporting for various, you know, over the years, various times I took that on, doing it for TPV, doing it for Talk Radio Europe in Spain. It's something I've always understood despite my mathematical dyslexia. It is going to be biblical, the poverty and the explosion of health problems in society as a result of that. And I came to the realisation a long time ago that none of this is by or due to bad policies or idiots at the wheel. They'd love you to believe that. We heard Nikki Campbell on Radio 5 Live last week saying, oh, these conspiracy theorists, Rachel, they give too much credit to these politicians. Politicians don't make policy. Politicians don't think about policy. They don't sit around thinking, what will we do? They do what they are told by think tanks. By think tanks. From the London School of Economics and elsewhere, roundtable groups. Rockefeller roundtable groups and spin-off groups, think tanks, tell politicians what to do. The politicians do it because they are hopelessly compromised. Sex scandals, financial misdeeds. They can't say fucking no. We can't say no. Hey Boris, this is going to fucking kill people. I know, Jeremy, but we can't say no. Why? Because, oh yeah, that's right, yeah, they've got videos. So we'll do things that we ourselves find totally and utterly repugnant. But we can't say no. Catastrophe coming. And nobody's aware of it. Fear porn on the Richie Allen Radio Show? No. I'm the only real journalist in the independent media. The only one who can hold his head up high. I don't do fear porn. I don't tell you lies. I don't exaggerate. I don't embellish. This is what's coming down the line. The drinking story on Burley's programme is only the tip of the iceberg. Mental breakdown. Mass mental breakdown in adults and in children. The breakup of relationships due to the relentless financial pressures that people are going to be under. Homelessness. You think it's bad now? You're going to see hundreds of thousands of people out of their homes. Unless something is done about it. And that's what we have to figure out, I suppose, really, as human beings. Going out with the programme today with Texas. Thanks so much to Matt O'Connor in the second hour, but special thanks to Louise Greffield, whom I enjoyed speaking with in hour one. That was Tuesday's Richie Allen Radio Show. Going out with Texas and Charlene Spiteri, and I am going to refresh that music playlist. I am. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday. I'll speak to you tomorrow at 5 o'clock. Until then, Simon Dolan on the programme again tomorrow at 5:25. Don't miss it. Bye now.